And if there's one word we can use to describe what all of the Sermon on the Mount is all about, what all of that is surprising. It's surprising. I mean, Jesus talks about the way that God values things, and he compares it and contrasts it to the way that the way and the things that the world values. And it's interesting because each and every time, because we are so conditioned by the world around us that it really kind of knocks us, you know, off our feet to think about some of this stuff. I mean, for example, our world values being rich and being powerful and being strong. And yet Jesus said that God blesses the poor and God blesses the humble. I mean, it's very surprising. It's the exact opposite of what we would think the opposite of what we think is valuable is what God thinks is valuable. We live in a world where getting revenge and getting back at our enemies is seen as a good thing. That's the best thing we can do. And yet Jesus said, God blesses those who are merciful. We think that we should get ahead no matter what it is. That as long as we're successful, as long as we ourselves are successful, we don't have to worry about people around us. We don't have to worry about other people, our neighbors. As long as we get ahead, that's all that matters. And it doesn't matter how we get ahead. So long as we're successful, the world will accept us. Jesus said, though, that God blesses the pure in heart, those whose intentions are pure. The way they do things is pure. And Jesus said that God blesses those who hunger and thirst for justice for everyone. Each and every time, each and every week, we've really seen God's surprising kingdom through Christ. And as we get to the very last one, we have another surprise. And that surprise is, there is no surprise. As we get to the last one, at least at face value as we read it, it seems like it's not surprising at all. It seems like the script has flipped a bit, and we don't have anything like that as surprising. It's just kind of what we've always expected, and here's what it is. By the way, buckle in. We're going to have a lot of Bible today, and I hope that's okay. But here's what Jesus says, his final beatitude is in Matthew chapter 5, verses 11 and 12. Here's the last thing he says in this opening. He says, God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things about you because you are my followers. So be happy about it and be glad, for a great reward awaits you in heaven. And remember, the ancient prophets were also persecuted in this way. In Matthew, the very last one, he says that God blesses us when we are persecuted because we are Christians. And ever since I've been in the church, as long as I can remember, before even, you know, when I was a little kid, before I was even baptized, before, you know, I had really taken this seriously, I was always taught that we will be persecuted. Okay? I was taught this in every possible way, that to be a Christian is to have people who are not religious. If you believe in God, people who don't believe in God, they will persecute you. They will make fun of you. They will laugh at you. That'll be the way it is. Now, this can happen. This persecution can take many, many forms. Like when I was in high school, we were taught that if we wear our WWJD bracelets, people will make fun of us. And if we don't listen to the music that's on MTV, because MTV was terrible, we were taught, and music done by people who don't sing about Jesus every three words, that was just the worst. So we were taught, okay, you'll be made fun of at school for this. That is persecution. They'd point to like this passage. And that's a small thing, but then kind of on a bigger level, we were always taught that, you know, like there's this culture war going on, and that our country used to have Christian values, but now people have fought against those values. And man, this time of year is really when you see it, because this time of year, you have everyone coming out the woodwork who wants to take Christ out of Christmas. And so they do that by making us say happy holidays. And that is persecution. We are being persecuted because we have to say happy holidays. Of course, my junior year of high school was in 2001. And so after that, on a much larger scale, then we were taught for obvious reasons, that there is an entire religion of people who wants to murder us because we are Christians. And so, I mean, it can range from something tiny and small to kind of big-ish or massive. But no matter what, I was taught again and again and again, I should be leery of people who do not share my religious faith because they're the ones who are going to persecute me. And this passage shows that. Now, as I got older, and I became more affluent in the Bible, and I became more just knowledgeable, and I realized that there is something a little bit surprising about this passage. You see, Jesus taught us that the reason we will be persecuted is because he was persecuted. Okay? What we are taught, essentially, the way he put it, he gave an illustration where he said that a servant is not greater than his master. He is our master. We are his servants. Therefore, whatever he went through, we will go through. So it stands to reason that not only will we be persecuted because we follow Jesus, but instead, we will be persecuted in the way that Jesus was persecuted. There is not a theologian on the planet who will disagree with that. That is exactly clearly what Jesus stated. And that creates a problem. Because as I got older and I read a lot more, I learned that Jesus wasn't persecuted the way that we teach our children and teach our churches that will be persecuted. Here's an example. You see, one day there was Jesus and he invited a man named Levi to be his disciple. Levi was a tax collector. Tax collectors, as we've discussed over and over, were essentially the worst human beings in Jewish society. The tax collectors were thought of as traitors to Rome. They were thought of as people who had sold out God by pledging allegiance to the Caesar. We'll come back to that later on. And everybody hated them. So Levi decides he's going to follow Jesus, and then he decides, I want to introduce my friends to Jesus. And as it turns out, Levi, being a tax collector who everybody else hates, his friends are other tax collectors, other sinners. And so Levi invites Jesus over for this meal, this party, where everybody's hanging out, and it is Jesus with all sorts of sinful people. And here's what we read. Happens. In the Gospel according to Mark, this is what happens, okay? Here's what we read. It says, later Levi invited Jesus and his disciples to his home as dinner guests, along with many other tax collectors and other disreputable sinners. Parentheses, there were many people of this kind, meaning the tax collectors and the disreputable sinners, among Jesus' followers. But when the teachers of religious law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with tax collectors and other sinners, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with such scum? You see, in this story, what you have is Jesus being persecuted. Jesus being mocked and laughed at, exactly like he said, but he's not mocked and laughed at by the worldly, irreligious people who have nothing to do with God. In fact, Mark says most of those guys actually followed Jesus, which is really amazing for two reasons. That means Jesus not only was the sort of dude who wanted to hang out with the broken and the sinful and the dirty of society, but also, more important than that, the broken and the sinful and the disreputable of society, they wanted Jesus around. I mean, this blows my mind that, like, it says that many of them followed Jesus. They wanted Jesus around. It's like these guys are out partying and they say, you know what we're missing? That rabbi we heard last week. Let's call that Jesus guy up and have him come down and party with us. And then Jesus went and did it. It's an amazing, amazing fact. Jesus was not persecuted or made fun of or mocked at all in this situation by anyone but the religious. It was the religious, powerful elite. The people who should have been on Jesus' side. The people Jesus should have been able to trust. They were the ones that were making fun of Jesus. They were the ones who were persecuting him. This is not at all an isolated event. Later on in Jesus' ministry, he is training a wide variety of disciples, more than 70 we read. He's training these guys, and he knows that he's going to leave one day, he's going to pass the baton off to them, and so he wants them to get an on-the-job training, kind of like an internship. And so he tells them, I'm sending you out to do the ministry I'm doing. Okay? He said, oh, as a warning, I am sending you into a world full of wolves, and you guys are like the sheep. He said, people will attack you, they will arrest you, they will whip you, they will put you in prison, you will stand before kings and leaders and governors, you will stand before these people, and they will hurt you. And we always read that passage as we should be afraid of people who don't believe in God. But funny story, in Matthew chapter 10, right before he talks about all of that, here's what we read. From Matthew, Jesus, we read, says, Jesus sent out the 12 apostles with these instructions. Don't go to the Gentiles or Samaritans, but only to the people of Israel, God's lost sheep. Now, we in our minds think about the people persecuting the apostles and the disciples as people who don't believe in God at all. We would expect if they're going to be persecuted, it will come down from Romans and Samaritans, who are code for the other people in the world who want to hurt you and aren't people of God. And yet Jesus says, I am sending you like sheep to wolves, but I'm not sending you to Romans or Gentiles. I'm sending you to the Jews. In other words, the apostles would be persecuted, not by people who did not believe in God, but instead by people who shared their religious faith. Again, this is a pattern. Just before Jesus dies, he has his last supper with his disciples. And he tells them, you should not be surprised if the world hates you. He said, the world hates me, and the world will hate you too. And then he says this to them. The Gospel according to John, chapter 16. After he says, the world will hate you, he says, I have told you these things so that you will not abandon your faith. For you will be expelled from the synagogues, and the time is coming when those who kill you will think they are doing a holy service for God. Now, first of all, Jesus talks about this being the world. He didn't mean when he said the worldly people, he didn't mean people who weren't Jews. He meant the Jews who ran the synagogues would have the authority to cast them out of the synagogues. And then he goes on, in case we're curious as to what's going on, he says the people who kill you will think they are doing a holy service for God. Now, we have to take off our 21st century goggles here, because in the 21st century, if I say there are people who want to kill you because they are serving God, every person in this room, including the unborn children, will think of one religion that I don't even have to say out loud. We're all thinking it. It's fine. Fun fact, the religion I'm referring to, you're all thinking about, did not exist for 600 years until after he said this. Jesus was not talking about people who are not God's people. Jesus was saying, God's own people will kill you and throw you out of the synagogue. I don't want to belabor the point, guys. I'm going to belabor the point because we need to get it through our heads. But when Jesus was persecuted, when Jesus faced trials, when his apostles faced trials, they did not come from the Romans, the godless heathen Romans. They did not come from the Gentiles. Oh, the people that are not part of God's people. They did not come from the Samaritans, the half-Jew, half-Gentile, hybrid nationality who just absolutely despised Israel and Israel despised them in return. That's not who attacked Jesus. If we are going to be following in Jesus' footsteps and being persecuted, we need to shift our expectations. Because Jesus' persecution came at the hands of the very people he should have been able to trust. And if you need one more piece of evidence of that, we can look at his death. You see, if I were to ask most people, okay, who was it that killed Jesus? Who was it that was responsible for Jesus' death? I mean, most people would say, yeah, the Romans. And that makes sense, okay? The Romans, at that point of the world, they were the only ones with really the authority to do things like carrying out capital punishment. And by the way, while we're here, the Romans loved to carry out capital punishment. So it makes sense that it would be that. Additionally, Jesus died by a execution on a Roman cross. He was put there by Roman soldiers. So you think, okay, it's the Romans who did this. But if you look closer at Scripture, that doesn't make any sense. You see, Jesus didn't break any law at all, but he specifically didn't break any Roman law. Every time Jesus asked about Rome, in fact, he goes out of his way to be respectful and deferential. Every time. That's a topic for another day. But every time that Jesus had Rome brought before him, he submitted and didn't worry at all about them. Okay, he was defiant, but he was subtly defiant in funny ways. Nothing that the Romans would pick up on. They had no reason to care about him, much less want to kill him. And so the question is, how did the Romans even end up with him? And the answer is, the Jewish people, who Jesus should have been able to trust, turned him over. It was the Jewish people, Jewish religious leaders to be specific, but Jewish religious people that Jesus should have been able to trust, who arrested him. And then put him through all sorts of this trial. And they went to Roman judges and the council and a Roman governor. Jesus went through all of that with the Romans. They charged, or with the Jews, I'm sorry. The Jews did this, they said, because Jesus was a blasphemer. Now, Rome could, they could care less about who's blaspheming what God. They don't care. And so, the Jews turn things over to Rome, and they know that they have to make up a new story. So they told the Romans, specifically Pontius Pilate, this guy is a rebel. He claims to be the rightful king of Israel, and he is going to attack you guys. We're doing you a solid. You see, because the Romans, well, they had no problem fighting. I mean, they'd rather not fight. I mean, propaganda always, always is cheaper than war. They'd rather just have everybody believe that it's peaceful as opposed to actually fighting. So it's interesting that in this situation, the Romans get Jesus, and the charge is this charge that Jesus is this king who's going to take over Rome. And the second Pontius Pilate, the governor in question, saw Jesus, I am convinced he had to stifle laughter. Jesus was a homeless drifter. Imagine in your mind homeless drifters. Now, make them Middle Eastern, that's Jesus. Okay? This guy has a ragtag group of following of like a dozen dudes, one of whom just sold him out. And on top of that, like a group of like criminals and sinful people and then like women, and nobody likes women back then. I mean, Jesus has no army. He has no followers as far as Rome's concerned. They don't think this is right at all. And so Pilate just says, yeah, Jesus, are you a king? And Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom was of this world, you'd see my followers fighting. They're not fighting. They're not fighting to let me free. I'm no threat to you at all. And they continued to talk, and at the end of it, Pilate was convinced, and he declared Jesus not guilty. I'm not sure we all realize that. Rome declared Jesus not guilty of any crime. Now, Pilate had to go tell the news to the people who had turned him over, who at this point had become an angry mob. And he told the angry mob, this guy's not guilty. And the angry mob did not take it well, to say the least. Angry mobs typically don't take anything well. Even when they're given what they want, they don't take it well. They still celebrate by rioting as opposed to being angry while rioting. Angry mobs are typically bad things. They don't take it well at all, in the least. And they begin to accuse Pilate of being a traitor. Pilate tried to satiate their bloodlust, okay? He said, look, there's this tradition with you guys where the Romans will free a criminal. Let's say Jesus is a criminal. Let me just free him to you guys. And they said, no, we want the terrorist named Barabbas instead. And so he did that. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to have him beaten within an inch of his life. That'll work, right? And they publicly beat Jesus within an inch of his life. And he figured that's surely enough. But it wasn't enough. Jesus' countrymen, Jesus' the people who shared his religious faith, they cried out again and again, "We want him crucified." They would not stop until he was dead. And they threatened Pilate. They said, "What? Do you have any allegiance to Rome? This guy says he's a king." And Pilate says, "You guys are the ones that are telling me that. If he's anybody's king, he's your king." And the people cried out over and again, "We have no king but Caesar." I said we'd come back to this. Remember the tax collectors, how they don't like the tax collectors? Because the tax collectors are traitors to their people? When push comes to shove, their hatred of Jesus, their bloodlust for Jesus' death made them so crazy that the people who had spent their lives persecuting and mocking and excluding tax collectors, calling them traitors, they declared publicly, "We have no king but Caesar." Their hatred was apparently bigger than their conviction toward God. And so we read this in Matthew chapter 27. This is the end result. We read this. We read that Pilate saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and that a riot was developing. So he sent for a bowl of water and he washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours." And all the people yelled back, "We will take responsibility for his death, we and our children." It may have been a Roman cross, it may have been Roman soldiers, but it was the Jews, Jesus' countrymen, the people who shared his religious devotion, who said, "We take responsibility for his death." That beatitude that tells us that we are blessed when we are persecuted for following Jesus, that's not a reference to a scary world around us that wants to kill us. I mean, that exists, okay? Let's not pretend that, you know, terrorists aren't terrible people, okay? That's not a controversial statement. Terrorism is bad, okay? Let's not pretend that there aren't people who really want to kill Christians. And look, I'm not going to get worked up about having to say Happy Holidays, but I get it, okay? It can be annoying if your whole life you said Merry Christmas and now people are telling you no, and it seems like, yeah, it's just annoying. I get that. And yeah, you're probably going to get made fun of for being a Christian. If it hasn't already happened, it'll happen. It is what it is. But far more likely than anything from outside the church hurting you deeply is people within the church will hurt you deeply. Here's why. Christian religion is super easy to follow. The Christian religion that says, "Hey, I get to go to heaven because Jesus died for me." Man, is that simple. Like, that's not hard to convince people. "Hey, you want to go to heaven? Yeah, why not? You want to go to heaven for free? Even better." I mean, that's super easy. But here's the thing. If we actually do the things Jesus did, if we actually preach the message Jesus preached, it's not a popular message, particularly in the church. If you preach, for example, unconditional love for everybody, inclusion for everybody, if you preach compassion and mercy and forgiveness and grace, if you preach that Jesus said that the meek are blessed, so we should not demand our own way. The humble are blessed, so we should not put ourselves above other people. That the poor are blessed, so we shouldn't be living for material possessions. On and on and on. If we actually follow in Christ's footsteps, people will think we're weirdos. People will think that we are taking shots at their religion. People will think that we are not being tough enough on sin. People, if we are the type of people that we're invited to the party by the sinners, people will say, "Well, that guy's not even a Christian." Jesus' teachings got him killed by his own people. I'll bet you a dollar if we also teach Jesus' teachings, we'll run into a whole lot of people among our own people who won't like it. But we're told that we're blessed when that happens. And here's the thing, this whole conversation seems kind of hopeless. I mean, if you can't have sanctuary at a church, where can you? And the answer is nowhere. I'm not trying to be a pessimist. I'm really not. I'm just being a realist. There is nowhere in this world, there is no group of people that you can fully put your trust in. There is no place that we are truly safe. Really. And I mean that. And that's it's depressing and unfortunate, but it's the truth. There is nowhere where we are fully safe the way we'd like to be. And we can't change that. What we can do is trust in God, in His presence, and recognize that He is the one who blesses us. Just as He blessed the prophets who were murdered by their people, just as He rose Christ from the dead as He was murdered by His people, just as the apostles who followed in Jesus' footsteps were murdered, and they one day will be risen from the dead. At the end of the day, there's nowhere we can go. And there's beautiful freedom in just admitting, yeah, everything's kind of terrible. And look, the church is less terrible than a lot of places. At least I'd like to think so. I'd work towards that. But being less terrible doesn't mean it's good. Here, if not in this congregation, in Christianity at large, if we are to be persecuted as Christ was persecuted, the persecution will come from within. It will be people who believe they're serving God. And that's no fun. But it does bring us to a place where we can fully surrender to who God is and say, you know what? We have nowhere else to go. We have nowhere else to turn. We have nowhere else to trust. And we can pledge allegiance to a God who never lets us go. Come hell or high water, God will not let us go. That's kind of beautiful. And so at the end of this the whole thing, as it turns out, it is kind of a surprising beatitude. But at the end of all of this, we continue to learn that while there may not be much safety in the world we live in, that there is safety for all eternity in the arms of God. And so our ninth and final week of our series about God blessing us is this. A life following Christ will get opposition even from religious people. But it's worth it. A life following Christ will get opposition from even religious people. But it is worth it. We began this morning with a clip for the last time. And it makes me sad to say it for the last time because I love the Munsters. If you don't love the Munsters, how dare you? Anyway. And we see Marilyn. We haven't seen much of Marilyn at all. She's typically not the one that anybody focuses on. But here's the thing with Marilyn. Marilyn is a total outcast. She's a total weirdo in her family. I mean, every guy in this room knows she's a beautiful woman. But in their family, that doesn't count. Because beautiful means a vampire. Good looking means a werewolf. Big, strong, and handsome is Frankenstein's monster. In this family, there's a little bit of a different standard of beauty. But here's what's amazing. Okay, we saw they're trying to help her. They give her the sleeping potion. Shenanigans will ensue. Over and over and over, we see them caring for Marilyn. They don't care that in her mind, she has the worst looks in the world. They don't mind that she is the weirdo. They don't even mind that she's not their own daughter. That is the aunt and the uncle, and they care for Marilyn as she is, regardless of anything else. And I have to be honest, as cheesy as it might sound, I think that's beautiful. And caring for people unconditionally, no matter who they are, that's what Jesus did. That's what we're called to do. And so there's two things we learn at the end of this lesson. Two takeaways, real quick here. The first thing is, don't be surprised. And if you get criticized by people who are in the church, high five, you're probably doing something right. So, keep at it. The second, perhaps most important thing, though, is this. If we place ourselves somewhere in this story, we're the Pharisees. We really are. You know, American Christianity, man, we are the powerful religion in the world. We are the religious majority, okay? Look, sometimes we feel oppressed. I'm not pretending like that stuff doesn't happen. But we're the biggest religion in this country, okay? It's still like 70% of people claim to be Christians or whatever the numbers are. It can be super easy to fall into the trap that the Pharisees did. We are all capable. And we need to humbly admit that it is not just possible, but it is probable, if unchecked, that we will become agents of oppression in this world. We will demand our own way. We will persecute people in the name of God. And we will simply make life miserable for the people around us. I can be that person. You can be that person. And the first step to making sure that doesn't happen is being willing to admit it. And then choosing each and every day to be different. To be better than that. To say, I know that the biggest persecutors and oppressors in the New Testament were religious people. We are religious people. We can be oppressors and persecutors. The good news is some of the Pharisees followed Jesus and stopped the oppression. And we can do that. And each and every day we have to choose which side we are on. The side of the oppressors, the side of the oppressed. When all is said and done, though, as we finish this series, and I appreciate you guys hanging with me for 9 weeks, as we finish this series, we are over and over and once again brought to a place where we are confronted with a surprising God. And maybe the most surprising thing of all is that God wants to bless us. God wants to bless you. You know, God is not just waiting to thump you. God is waiting to bless you. That's a radical, kind of ridiculous statement. But to be a Christian is to believe that. To believe that God doesn't want, He doesn't want to punish us for our misdoing, for our wrongdoings. But as Jamie said during the communion meditation, that even though we have been subject to maybe His anger, that His kindness and grace and mercy is bigger than that. That's the God we serve. And that is absolutely a beautiful, ridiculous idea that we're invited to embrace. So when the musicians come forward, they're going to sing a song. Hopefully, that's on the PowerPoint. Oh, let it never be said that we are professional around here. And we're not a perfect church. Not just because of that. We're not a perfect church. I try to tell people, look, when you're signing up for Ashland Christian Church, you're signing up to be one day disappointed. It happens. We are imperfect people. And we're not perfect. But we do serve a perfect God. We serve a God who is worth following no matter what. It will always be worth it. And so we want to connect, call, and cultivate. We want to meet new people, share the gospel, grow up as we do it. What that means is if you've never made the decision to follow Christ in your own life, we got a nice warm baptistry. We can do that. If you're already an immersed believer, you've repented, you've been baptized, we can talk about all of that as well. At the end of the day, though, we serve a God who wants to bless us. And very often it will be in surprising ways. But the more God surprises us, the more beautiful it gets. And it's a choice that we have to accept that as we stand and as we sing.